KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This first of a kind purging is going to undermine the strength of our military.
A retired admiral reacts to President Trump's firing of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and others. For Saturday, February 22nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Ahead, the big conservative political action conference gathers just outside D.C. Elon Musk brandished a chainsaw. We'll look at how the event known as CPAC has changed over the years. Plus, Arab and Muslim Americans in Michigan on Trump's plans for Gaza.
Looking at it from my point of view, he doesn't care about the Palestinians. You know, he cares about the real estate that they're on.
And a new documentary film traces the early days of one of the biggest bands ever, Led Zeppelin.
We wanted it to be in their words only, hearing from them telling their own stories for the first time.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers have 48 hours to explain what they accomplished in their jobs over the last week or risk being fired. NPR's Emma Bowman reports the move comes amid a massive effort led by tech billionaire Elon Musk to slash the federal workforce.
Musk gave notice about the apparent ultimatum hours before it was sent out. Writing on X, he said, quote, "Failure to respond will be taken as a resignation." The emails were sent by the Office of Personnel Management and asked workers to reply with a summary of their work by the end of Monday. It's unclear what legal weight the threat carries. Many federal workers have job protections that protect them from being fired without cause. Musk is leading the DOGE team, a project to slash federal spending that's behind the recent mass firings of government workers. It's a familiar tactic for Musk. The billionaire pulled a similar move at Tesla and after he bought Twitter, where he mandated weekly reports from his employees on productivity. Emma Bowman, NPR News.
Pope Francis remains hospitalized in critical condition after suffering a respiratory crisis today. The 88-year-old pontiff has been hospitalized for more than a week. NPR's Ruth Sherlock is at St. Peter's Square, where the mood is somber.
Here at St. Peter's Square, just after the news breaks that Pope Francis is in a critical condition in hospital, I find a group of young teenagers standing in a circle, praying in a quiet murmur. They're praying for the Pope's health, they say, but also for his salvation, for a direct ascent to heaven, should he pass away. The group's leader, Don Marco, tells me if he had to summarize Francis's papacy, it would be in one word, mercy. He says this Pope tried to break down the trappings of the Vatican, the idea of the Vatican as a wealthy, powerful empire, and bring it back to simpler Christian roots. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
President Trump used a speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference today to take aim at Ukraine. Speaking to CPAC attendees, Trump said he wants something in return from Ukraine for the billions of dollars the U.S. spent helping the country defend itself against Russia.
Europe gave it in the form of a loan. They get their money back. We gave it in the form of nothing, so I want them to give us something for all of the money that we put up. And I'm going to try and get the war settled, and I'm going to try and get all that death ended.
Russian state media say preparations are underway for a face-to-face meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is NPR. An outbreak of cholera has killed nearly 60 people and sickened about 1,300 others in Sudan. Health officials say the outbreak in the city of Kosti was traced back to contaminated drinking water. The city's water plant stopped working after it was attacked by a paramilitary group. Major League Baseball is testing out a new automated challenge system in spring training. Pitchers, catchers, and batters may challenge an umpire's calls. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports the review is powered by an automated strike zone.
On Thursday, during a spring game between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Chicago Cubs, an ordinary fastball in the first inning became history when Cubs pitcher Cody Petit tapped his head after the umpire called a ball. That triggered the Major League's first ever ABS challenge, as it's called. The Jumbotron showed the computerized replay of the pitch and that it was, in fact, a strike. Afterward, the Dodgers' Max Muncy had good humor about getting the short end of the historic challenge.
It was a pitch that I definitely thought was a strike. He balled it, and I look out, and the pitcher seemed very excited to challenge that one. And when he challenged it, I knew it was going to get overturned. And I went, oh, man, I'm going to be the first one on this. This is great.
The soonest the challenge system could appear in the regular season is 2026. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Phoenix.
The first and only museum dedicated to Leonardo da Vinci in the United States is set to open later this year in Colorado. The new facility will feature life-size machine replicas based on da Vinci's sketches and interactive displays. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne, in for Scott Detrow. Firings at the most senior level of the U.S. military are causing concern among present and former military leadership about the political independence of the nation's defense forces. Last night, President Donald Trump fired four-star General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., a one-time fighter pilot who was only the second black officer to hold the title of Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In total, six Pentagon officials have been fired, including the first woman to lead the Navy, the vice chief of the Air Force, and the top lawyers for the Army, Navy, and Air Force. The Trump administration insists the firings are due to the military leadership's focus on diversity, saying that it has lost sight of its role as a combat force. But Rear Admiral Mike Smith, president of the National Security Leaders for America, says these changes are about politics. He joins me now. Welcome, Admiral.
Hi, Don. Thank you for having me.
Please expand on that, how these changes are about politics.
It's unprecedented for an incoming president to come in and purge the senior leadership of the military. You know, the one thing that has kept our military strong has been the fact that it is apolitical. That no matter who the president is, that your oath to the Constitution is, you obey every lawful order, no matter what the policy is or what the party is. And now this first of a kind purging is going to add a whole new dynamic, which ultimately is going to undermine the strength of our military.
I want you to amplify that point you just made, that an apolitical military is important to national defense.
It's really the bedrock of our country. We've always said that the military will not be involved in politics. You have civilian control of the military. The civilian leadership at the political level is replaced as a new administration comes in. But despite that change, the military leadership is there to serve whoever happens to be in charge, because that's what America is all about. It's civilian control of the military. And you don't want the military officers to be wondering and questioning now, well, I know that's a lawful order, but it's being given by a president who only has 2 months left, and now they have to have a new calculus about whether or not they'll be fired by the next president by enacting the order of the current president. That will undermine so many aspects of our strength and our readiness and our effectiveness.
I'm wondering what kind of impact it can have on people considering joining the military, on recruitment.
You know, I think that you have to step back and take a look at the actions that are being done. Some of the reporting is that it's based on DEI. The official statements they put out don't say that, but some of the reporting from folks inside the administration does say that it's because of that. So if that's true, we're going to have not only a problem recruiting, as you're bringing up, but what about retention? I mean, I know Lisa Franchetti, the Chief of Naval Operations, the first female in that position. Matter of fact, when I was in my first admiral job in the Pentagon, she was a captain, and there was a conversation where she was wondering if she was going to be selected to admiral because a board was coming up. She was so spectacular then that I looked at her then and I said, Lisa, you have no worries about making admiral. Not only that, we will all work for you one day. Not because of her gender, but because of how great an officer she was. So what signal are we sending to today's Lisas out there who are doing fantastic jobs commanding their ships? What are we telling them? We don't want you to serve in leadership positions because you're a woman? If this is all true, we have a huge problem, both with recruiting, but also with retention.
General Brown, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, served in an advisory role. People will ask, shouldn't the president have the control to put advisors he trusts in those positions?
Presidents do have that authority. When the time comes for the chairman's tour to be over, then they can nominate an individual just like he did in his first term when he nominated General Milley to be the chairman. It was his choice to put that general in as the chairman. But no one has come in and fired a chairman like this. Senator Reid, who sits on the Senate Armed Service Committee, wrote an op-ed today and suggesting that it was for perceived political disloyalty. No serving officer demonstrates political disloyalty. They've been brought up in an organization where you follow civilian leadership. That's what they have been brought up to do. That's what their oath to the Constitution is all about.
We should note that the firings of these military leaders that we've been talking about, it comes amidst other layoffs. It was announced on Friday that 5,400 civilian Pentagon employees will be fired starting next week. The ultimate plan is to reduce the Pentagon's workforce of more than 700,000 full-time civilian employees by up to 8%. Would you worry that the military could be under-resourced?
Well, if you start to get to those levels, and the 5,000 next week are not at those levels, but if you get to that level, you have to see, are you now cutting into the muscle of the organization? You know, the Pentagon, the strength is that we have continuity. The political leadership changes every 4 to 8 years. The continuity provided by the civil servants who are there for years and years serving their country in critical positions, they need to be protected so that the lessons learned don't have to be repeated.
That was retired Rear Admiral Mike Smith, president of National Security Leaders for America. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate having me on.
CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, has been an annual event that also serves as a temperature check on the direction of the Republican Party. Since President Trump barreled onto the scene a decade ago, that direction has increasingly been his own.
70% of Americans believe that what we are doing is right and we are keeping our promises. That's all we're doing when you think is keeping our promises. That's all we had to do. And their promises weren't worthwhile to go and vote for.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has been covering this year's CPAC. joins me in the studio now. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Don.
I remember one of the first CPACs I covered. It was back during the George W. Bush administration. There were no chainsaws there, for one. This is your first one. What's your takeaway from the event?
Honestly, it's unlike anything else in politics. I mean, there were multiple cardboard cutouts of Trump and the MyPillow founder Mike Lindell that people were lining up to take selfies with. There was merchandise simultaneously calling the January 6, 2021 insurrection a Fedsurrection, implying that it was a setup, and also celebrating people as political prisoners. And it felt like every third person that was attending was somebody who was either present at, supportive of, or pardoned for their actions on January 6th. Even though this wasn't a Trump campaign event, the closest parallel I can think of is an all-day Trump rally with its energy and mishmash of speakers, but just spread out and magnified over 3 days. There was, of course, billionaire Trump advisor and overseer of the Doge movement to shrink the government, Elon Musk. He did receive that golden chainsaw from the president of Argentina before declaring, quote, "I am become meme," to great applause.
Also at CPACs of yours, some of the biggest names who got enthusiastic responses when I was there included people like Dick Cheney, Mitt Romney, Chris Christie. I take it they're not present and accounted for now.
Not exactly. Not at all. Not even Ron or Rand Paul. Everything is under the umbrella of Trumpism all the way down. There were panels about January 6th. Several cabinet secretaries were there sharing how their agency or department plans to implement Trump's agenda, and a lot of nods to that Doge effort and a notion pushed by Musk that they'll save so much money they can return some of it to taxpayers.
It's money that's taken away from things that are destructive to the country and from organizations that hate you.
So Doge checks, I guess. We'll keep an eye out for those. But there is a long list of things Trump has done in his first 30 days back in the White House. How did those play with this crowd?
So many of the speakers and attendees I spoke with say Trump has already won. He's already done everything he's promised on the campaign trail, like ending wokeness or his push for mass deportations.
The illegal alien criminals are being sent home. We're draining the swamp and we're restoring government by the people, for the people.
I mean, CPAC, Don, is basically the opening turn on the Trump 2.0 victory lap. Unlike his first 30 days, there wasn't a whole lot of newsmaking going on, but it was like a callback to his greatest hits on the trail.
And what does the CPAC of today say about where the zeitgeist is?
Well, over the last decade of Trump, the tent of conservatism has taken on some interesting shapes. It's a little bit smaller, but also deeper and definitely Trump-shaped.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler, fresh from this year's CPAC conference just outside Washington. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Pope Francis remains hospitalized in critical condition. The Vatican says the 88-year-old pontiff experienced an asthma-like crisis today, which required high flows of oxygen. Russian state media say preparations have started for a face-to-face meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Officials say the potential talks could involve broad discussions on a wide range of topics, including the war in Ukraine. More federal government workers might lose their jobs. NPR has confirmed that employees received emails today asking them to provide an account for what they did in the last week or face being fired. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered. I'm John Gagne. Lately, host Scott Detrow has been having conversations on the ways movies can inspire us, surprise us, even disappoint us. I'll let Scott take it from there.
Now it's time for our weekly segment where some of NPR's film experts and self-proclaimed film experts get together to discuss what's been on their minds. Today, we've got All Things Considered producer Mark Rivers. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Scott.
And NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour host Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
Hey, Scott.
Mark, what are we thinking about today?
I want to talk about who I think are some of the bankable young actors today. Let's say under 40. I'm thinking Timothy Chalamet, Glenn Powell, Zendaya, Austin Butler, Margot Robbie, Florence Pugh, Tom Holland, maybe Michael B. Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Aisha, do you agree with this list? Did I leave anybody important out?
I don't know if I believe that there are any bankable actors anymore.
A tragedy on its own.
Well, I mean, I think there are bankable franchises, but I think it's hard to be able to tell if a lot of these stars are the ones who are driving people to go see those movies, or if it's the sort of the franchises they're leading, whether it's Twisters or, you know, Dune. But I understand. Keep going.
I think
talk a little bit more.
I think you're right. I think IP takes primacy. But if we're talking who is being put in these IP projects and who I think the studios think are going to put butts in seats, I think what I'm getting at is this list of actors I think that are bankable, it's a very white list. And in Black History Month, I'm thinking about how I want to see my people prosper. I'm thinking about just what roles are being afforded to Black actors right now in this day and age, the kind of roles that they can get.
What's interesting about the timing of all of this, Mark, is that this year is somehow 10 years out from the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite debacle, which for those who do not follow this closely, was the year that literally every actor and actress nominated for an Oscar was white.
Yeah, so this was back in 2015, and it was actually 2 years in a row. And this hashtag was started by this woman, April Rain, Black woman, who was not a Hollywood insider. She's like a campaign finance lawyer, but she was big on what was Black Twitter, and she posted this hashtag, and it really blew up. In the second year that the Oscars shut out any non-white nominees, there were boycotts. Jada Pinkett Smith boycotted, Spike Lee boycotted. And the Academy said they wanted to double its numbers as far as women. They wanted to double people of color. Back in 2014, there's a study that LA Times did that found that around 95 to 96% of the membership was white. Some around 70% was male. And Cheryl Boone Isaacs, who was the head of the Academy then, really spearheaded this initiative to diversify those ranks. And I think an Oscar problem is an industry problem too, as well. Do you think there was any progress after that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Oscars are definitely the most prominent thing that we often think about when we're thinking about progress when it comes to women and people of color. But it is very much a industry-wide problem as well. I think about the fact that as recently as just like in 2023, when Taraji P. Henson was doing the press tour for The Color Purple, the musical version of that.
Now that there's something about good loving that all you ladies should know.
She was going around talking about how, yes, she's a veteran actress. She is able to star in certain movies. She's been nominated for an Oscar before, but she still struggles to prosper in the same way that some of her peers have financially.
And I want to say, after those back-to-back Oscar years, and I think there was this actually kind of a pretty big explosion of kind of Black art that came out in, like, say, 2016. You had Moonlight, which won Best Picture, infamously won Best Picture of the year. year at the next year's ceremony. And you had other kind of benchmarks. You had, you know, you had Black Panther in 2018, which is like, which showed that that IP franchises can be led by an all-black cast and make money, not just here and overseas.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
You had a movie like Girls Trip, which showed that black women could be raunchy and fun and quirky and also, you know, bring in dollars.
Okay, now here's what I want. Let me get 3 shots of whiskey with a Coke to chase. Coke Zero, though. I'm watching my figure.
Dina, you know this is only an hour flight.
Oh, well, then in that case, let me go ahead and get those 3 shots now and then bring me a shot of Bailey's once we get into cruising altitude.
And a lot of these movies, you know, it provided these rich roles for folk like Daniel Kaluuya, Tiffany Haddish, Letitia Wright, Winston Duke. And you would think, looking at some of those guys, that they would have kind of these rich careers going forward. But I'm looking at the landscape, and a lot of those guys have not had the kind of similar successes that their contemporary white peers have had to me.
So of the black actors today, who do you think has had a career most comparable to their white peers?
I mean, obviously someone, like I mentioned earlier, up front, like Zendaya. I think she's got into the big tentpole projects like Dune. She's been in kind of smaller, more adult dramas like Challengers from last year.
How often does this happen? Going after the same girl?
Not as often as you think.
We usually have different types.
So you're saying I should be flattered?
Aren't you everybody's type?
I also think about someone like Zoe Saldana. She's been in the industry for a long time. She's kind of been like, you know, the girl in both movies with an all-black cast, movies with an all-white cast. And she's been in these gigantic successes like Avatar and like you know, Guardians of the Galaxy and Avengers movies. I think the problem with Zoe is that she's had to be kind of blue and green for the last, like, you know, blue or green for the last like 10 years or so.
That's a good point.
And I'm grateful for someone like Emilia Perez that has allowed her to actually act in her own skin color. But I think as far as...
As a non-alien,
as an actual human.
I mean, here's the thing. I've already said this before, but I think like the concept of a actor in Hollywood these days is not the same as it was 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So Tom Cruise, Will Smith, those types of things, like those are not the benchmarks.
Things of the past.
Yeah, they're not the benchmarks anymore. Mm-hmm. I can imagine someone like Kiki Palmer having a career that is similar to someone like Jennifer Lawrence. She has range. She's also just very affable and very personable.
Kiki Palmer is someone I want to see have like a screwball comedy kind of career. You know, like I want to see her in stuff like His Girl Friday. I want to see her having a great time. I think Kiki Palmer to me is almost more, she's more of a social media star than she's a movie star. Like I think we're kind of squandering her talents on social media.
Yeah, I mean, actually, even when I think about it, she is a child actress. She's a Disney kid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could even say that Kiki Palmer's trajectory should be similar to someone like Ariana Grande, but we are not seeing that because she, like Ariana, can sing, dance, she can do all the things. Mm-hmm. And that is something that, like, I hope that someday we are able to value her in that way.
So this is a broader problem then of what projects are being greenlit, and also, Mark, as you said, where those projects are going.
Yeah, you know, kind of what Aisha said, like the way movies are being made now is different. But that trickles down to where, so if the white actors are suffering because of that, if you can't sell a Margot Robbie movie, you have to sell it as a Barbie movie, then the black actors, I feel, suffer even more. And I think there's still kind of a lack of imagination from studio heads about what they want to see black mm-hmm. actors be in. You know, I think they make calculations. Like if you put 2 black leads in the same movie, all of a sudden it's a black movie. All of a sudden it's not going to travel overseas. I think it's a lack of imagination. You know, I think there's still a biopic might be safe, you know, or a movie about trauma or slavery might be a little bit safer, but I think there's kind of other more fun and kind of stylistically or tonally diverse roles. I think black actors still struggle to get those types of roles.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that, like, if the studios are not going to promote the films, and of course this is an industry-wide problem, like even George Clooney movies that drop on Apple Plus are not, like, you know, getting a lot of play. But I think if it's an industry-wide problem, it falls on people like myself, film critics, to sort of champion the movies that are getting made, because they are getting made. I think it's just they're harder to find. And so I think of a movie like Rye Lane, which came out a couple of years ago, directed by Rain Allen Miller, a really delightful British rom-com that kind of has elements of Before Sunrise and Love Actually.
Gonna meet my ex for the first time since the breakup.
And you're still calling it the breakup.
I thought we were fine. We were better than fine. We moved in together, but we had Hamilton tickets.
This is serious commitment.
I wish more people had seen it. It was on Hulu at one point. I don't know if it's still there, but it's really important for people to just, like, seek them out, because they do exist. There is a problem. There is a problem with the industry and making those movies, but they are getting made. It's just harder to find.
All right. We'll do this again next week. That was NPR's Mark Rivers and Aisha Harris. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Talks about the future of Gaza continue in the Middle East after President Trump suggested earlier this month a U.S. takeover of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territory. Candidate Trump picked up significant support among Arab and Muslim voters in the key swing state of Michigan in last year's election. NPR's Sarah McCammon recently traveled to Dearborn and Southeast Michigan and joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Don.
So you spent time in and around Dearborn. It's one of the nation's most heavily Muslim and Arab communities. Just days after President Trump again repeatedly talked about the U.S. taking over the Gaza Strip and resettling Palestinians in neighboring countries. I'm based in that part of the world, and I had some of those conversations in that area as well. Mine were within hours of Trump's comments. I found people very reluctant to talk. What did you hear from those that you met?
Yeah, you know, Don, I also ran into some of that reticence to talk. I spent some time at the largest mosque in the country there in Dearborn, and several people didn't want to talk about politics. But from those I did speak with, I heard a range of reactions, including disappointment and concern, and also a lot of skepticism about Trump's proposal. I visited a coffee shop in Dearborn Heights, which, as you know, is a heavily Arab and Muslim area where Trump outperformed Vice President Kamala Harris in November by several points. And there I met Mujtaba Hadi. He's a recent college graduate and an engineer. And I asked him about Trump's plan to relocate Palestinians.
He talks about it from like a positive point of view, how he wants to build community for them and get them out of the region. But to be honest, looking at it from my point of view, he doesn't care about the Palestinians. You know, he cares about the real estate that they're on. And I feel like that's his priority more than anything else.
And, you know, Hadi told me he didn't vote in the November election because he wasn't pleased with what he was hearing from Trump or the Democrats. His friend Abbas Alwisha is also an engineer. He voted third party in the election, but for similar reasons, similar concerns. And he's also worried about Trump's plans for Gaza.
If people want to move, it's on their own. But he can't forcibly do this. We've seen it historically. It's not good. America's looked at the leader in the world, but when you're doing these things, or where you're saying these things, you want to forcibly move a population, that's not right.
And you know, we should note, Don, that the Trump administration has offered mixed messages about that. The White House said that any move of Palestinians would be temporary, but Trump has talked about permanent relocation.
So we mentioned that there was a notable shift in the vote toward Trump among many Arab and Muslim Americans, a group that had historically leaned toward Democrats 4 years early. Joe Biden carried this area by a wide margin.
Right.
What did you hear from Trump supporters about how they're feeling now? And again, including from some community leaders you talked to.
You know, one of the things I noticed, Don, and this is a phenomenon I think we have both seen before with Trump supporters, sometimes they don't take everything he says completely seriously. And I saw that with this newer group of Trump voters as well. Faye Nemmer is CEO of the MENA American Chamber of Commerce in Dearborn. She says she voted for Trump after a long history of voting for Democrats, and she sees Trump's proposed takeover of Gaza as unrealistic.
We feel like that is as likely and as practical as Canada becoming the 51st state or as Greenland becoming a property of the U.S. So we're not paying too much attention to what he's saying, more so monitoring what he's doing.
Nemmer notes that Trump has been in talks with leaders of Arab nations who have rejected this plan, including the King of Jordan. And she says she did appreciate his outreach to local Arab and Muslim voters during the campaign.
And Sarah, if your experience was at all like mine, so much of the support for Trump or the abstaining from voting was rooted in just this strong, strong anger, even hatred for Biden administration policies, specifically support of Israel.
I would agree with that. I heard again and again frustration with the status quo and a sense that many of these, especially community leaders, were hopeful that by supporting Trump, they would see some change. They talked about his promise to be a peacemaker in the region and in the world, and their hope was that he would somehow bring a change to the status quo and the war.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Sarah McCammon is a political correspondent at NPR.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be right back. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Germans head to the polls on Sunday in a national election that will likely mean a change of power at the top of the government. The frontrunner to become the country's next chancellor is a conservative politician with a business background, and he wants to restore Germany's status as a European powerhouse, both economically and militarily. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
One of the first German politicians to respond to the Trump administration's unilateral approach to ending Russia's war in Ukraine was this man. Friedrich Merz staunchly stood up for Europe and said he has no illusions about Russia. Merz will likely become Germany's next chancellor.
He has always been a conviction politician.
Norbert Röttgen has known Merz for more than 30 years. The two politicians for the center-right Christian Democratic Union Party entered parliament together. Röttgen says most German politicians specialize in compromise and the art of making policy.
Whereas his fundamental access to politics is the realm to realize what I believe in.
Röttgen says the 69-year-old Merz, who hails from a conservative family line of lawyers and who spent a stint as a management consultant, believes, above all, in decency.
Societally conservative, traditional values, then a strong free market conviction, and then he is a fundamental pro-European and transatlanticist.
And that will be crucial as Germany navigates an increasingly thorny relationship with a Trump administration bent on ending Russia's war in Ukraine as quickly as possible, so far without inviting Europe or Ukraine to the table.
I think the Europeans have not really found a collective way forward. You have all sorts of ideas that are contradicting each other.
Yada Pugliarin, director of the Berlin office at the European Council on Foreign Relations, says the outgoing administration of Chancellor Olaf Scholz has not helped build a cohesive way forward for Europe on Ukraine.
I think Friedrich Merz, by disposition, would be more open to also support Ukraine more decisively, but he has to work in a framework. He will be constrained by his coalition partner and also by the German population.
Because Merz's party is polling at 30%, he will be leading talks with one or two other parties to form a coalition government. It could be summer before Friedrich Merz has the opportunity to put his mark on Germany. Hints of how he will lead, though, have trickled out in recent weeks. Earlier this month, Merz got into trouble with his own party when he agreed to work with the far-right AfD party to pass a motion that would have toughened up Germany's immigration policy. The motion failed after significant backlash against Merz for breaking a long-time taboo in German politics, agreeing to work with a party seen by mainstream political parties as a threat to Germany's democracy.
Es ist meine Hoffnung, dass es nicht passiert.
On the streets of Berlin, voter Ute Wolters says she hopes Merz does not break a promise he made to refuse to govern with the AfD, which is polling in second place behind Merz's party. Wolters says she thinks Merz is flirting with populism, and she says populism is the last thing Germany needs right now. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
Malcolm X is often portrayed as an angry black man. His daughter says this is wrong.
Many people have been miseducated about who my father was, but my father just insisted his country live up to liberty and justice for all of its citizens.
Ilyasa Shabazz on the 60th anniversary of her father's death. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Winter Johnston with these headlines. The Vatican says Pope Francis remains in critical condition after suffering an asthma-like crisis that required high flows of oxygen. The 88-year-old pontiff was hospitalized more than a week ago for a lung infection. President Trump addressed the annual gathering of the Conservative Political Action Conference outside of Washington today. His speech comes a little more than a month into his second term in office. The Trump administration says it will not support a UN resolution that urges Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine. The UN General Assembly is set to consider the issue on Monday, the third anniversary of the Russian invasion. I'm Winsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Natalie Morales usually plays characters that are full of life. From parks and recreation to no hard feelings, she's often the fun, irreverent friend who injects a bit of energy to the plot. Now she's bringing that vibe to a very different role, the title character in the new movie, My Dead Friend Zoe. The film is about a veteran who keeps being visited by the spirit of a friend from the Army.
It is about these people happen to be veterans, but I think it's sort of universal because I think a lot of people have survivor's guilt.
Natalie Morales spoke to my colleague Rachel Martin on NPR's Wildcard. That's the Pick a Card podcast, where life and death are often topics of conversation.
Okay, first three cards, one, two, or three.
Let's go with two.
Two. What activity gave you a sense of freedom as a kid?
I used to climb a lot of trees, which did give me a sense of freedom. And I grew up with a mango tree in my backyard. That is a very Miami thing to say and a very Latin girl thing to say. I didn't have a lemonade stand. I had a mango stand, and I sold mangoes.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Like,
I had
for
a whole
how much?
Mango. I can't remember, but I do remember that other kids in my neighborhood were also selling mangoes, and that was not cool. So I combined, and I made a mango monopoly, and I was quite successful at it. But yeah, I climbed a lot of trees.
Amazing.
And I would also, we had this little like shed in the back, and I would climb up there and just look at the highway behind my house and the sky and stuff. And that definitely made me feel freer. I think I felt a little bit confined where I grew up. I don't know. My mom was very protective of me, so I think that made me feel like I had some sort of freedom just to be able to look out at the world.
Yeah, I think we all need that, like that sense of perspective and just reminding yourself, especially when you're young. Like, it's not all here. The world is a big place, and it's bigger than the four walls that you're being raised in, and you get to dream a little bit when you have some perspective out a window. Mm-hmm. Okay. One, two, or three?
I'll do two.
Two. Does the idea of an infinite universe excite or scare you?
Both. It's scary and exciting. It's scary to feel small, and it's also liberating to feel small.
There are some people who think that the idea of forever is just, is fundamentally unmooring.
I understand that. Yeah, yeah. I think there are so many things in life that are not explainable that you have to start to, if you want to keep going and you want to make sense of anything, you have to accept that you won't know everything. Yeah. And you have to go, like, I always think about this. My dog, Taco.
Taco.
He's the best. He flies with me sometimes. And one time, when he's used to it now, but earlier he would sit on my lap, and he would look out the window like he does in a car, right? And as the plane is taking off and it's taxiing down the runway, he's looking at all the things as he would at a car window, other people walking around, other cars, things going. And then the plane takes off and everything gets smaller and smaller. And as I can tell that it's not making sense to him that everything's getting smaller, he just goes, eh, well, and then gives up and then sits down. And I think about that all the time because I'm like, I feel like he just moved on in his life. He went, well, everything shrunk, and I'm just gonna turn around because I don't get that.
I want Taco to be my spiritual leader.
Yeah.
Like that kind of acknowledgement. And
yeah.
Just let it go. Just get over it.
That's kind of what you got to do with a lot of stuff. Like, yeah, I'm not going to understand that. I wasn't. My small brain is probably never going to get the idea of a completely infinite universe, but it's there. And so I have to kind of marvel at it and also then just like decide what I want for lunch.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bless Taco. We have one more. One, two, or three?
One.
One. What truth guides your life more than any other?
Rachel, these are so deep.
I know.
This is going to sound really super simple, but it was kind of life-changing for me, and it was something that I really came to believe in the last like 5 years, which is that no one is supposed to be anything other than what they are. Like, you are not, there's no supposed to, there's no should, there's no none of that. You just, there's no right way to be you other than what's already there. Like, I think that so much time is wasted and energy is spent, and there's so much strife in like trying to be something the right way, the right kind of mom, the right kind of daughter, the right kind of radio show host, the right kind of person. And it is already there. And so, like, I really try to listen to my gut and my instinct and whatever the expression of me feels right and feels solid and doesn't feel like a betrayal to myself. And that's what I really try to let guide me in life in general. I always want to have, like, integrity with myself and like at the end of the day go like, oh, I didn't betray myself in that moment at all.
Mm-hmm. Was there a big should in your life?
I think there were many big shoulds. There was a lot of pressure, especially like in the career that I had. There's so many examples of, you know, should, right? Like of what you should look like. And then I realized that the people that I really admired and the most successful people were the people that just did it the way they wanted to do it. They just were themselves. But also in life, you know, I think I wanted to do it right. And then it kind of was like, oh, there is no right way. There's no right way. There's just what you are. I mean, not to get too, like, I don't know, petty about it, but like a flower just blooms. It just does what it does. It doesn't look to the side to see how other flowers are looking and like how they're doing it. It just does it. And it faces the sun. It faces the day. It just blooms the way it's meant to. And that's kind of what I try to think about all the time.
That is a lovely, lovely idea. Yeah.
Thanks.
Natalie Morales, thank you so much for doing this. Her new movie is called My Dead Friend Zoe. It has been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Rachel. So nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
To hear the rest of that conversation, follow NPR's Wildcard podcast. There are some musical acts that just seem like they've always been there. When we listen to their work by streaming or on vinyl or CD or even cassette tape or 8-track, it's hard to imagine when these songs weren't part of our lives. One such band is Led Zeppelin. Formed in 1968, this supergroup was made up of two little-known musicians from England's Midlands, singer Robert Plant and drummer John Bonham, and seasoned session musicians Jimmy Page on guitar and John Paul Jones on bass. The group went on to become one of the biggest rock bands ever. Their exploits are legendary. The band tore through the 1970s, setting sales and concert records, and burnishing a reputation for hard playing and hard living. It all came to an end, though, in 1980, when John Bonham died and the band split up. Rather than focus on the tours and debauchery, a new documentary, Becoming Led Zeppelin, looks at their early years and remind us that legends do not arrive fully formed. Watching the film, directed by Bernard McMahon and produced by Allison McGordy, you're reminded of the magnetism of singer Robert Plant and guitarist Jimmy Page. But when I sat down with the filmmakers, I was more curious about the overall dynamic in the group. So very distinct personalities come through as we watch these interviews you did with them. And can I just say that John Paul Jones was such a fascinating character in this film, and he's probably the least well-known member of the band.
When I told my colleagues and the people that employed me that I'm giving up session work, I'm going to join a rock and roll band, everybody said, "You're mad. You're completely crazy."
Bass guitar, John Paul Jones. John Paul Jones.
I just found it riveting listening to him talk about his influences, talking about being on stage with the other members.
That was the great joy when we met him. It was like, you know, he was like this terrific raconteur, and which after a while made sense because he's like the son of vaudeville entertainers. His mum and dad had a vaudeville act together. And so I just remember thinking, my goodness, if we can get this guy on the screen, we have gold here, because he's so charismatic and interesting and entertaining.
An important piece of this film is John Bonham's voice. He, of course, died in 1980, but having his voice present along with the others seems so critical. You had an old tape of an interview with him. How did you come by that and some of the other personal recordings and pictures and notes that you have of his life? Allison?
Well, the first thing was that Deborah Bonham, John Bonham's sister, gave us the home videos that no one's ever seen before, that Jack Bonham, John Bonham's father, had filmed. So we're able to see John Bonham for the first time with his first drum kit and in his childhood house and garden where he lived. And then Bernard discovered three tapes of audio recordings that we were able to use to hear his voice in the film. One of these he found as far afield as Australia, that was in the archives at the University of Canberra, that had been mislabeled, so nobody knew existed. So with that and the other two tapes, and then the home videos provided by Deborah Bonham, we were able to tell his story equally.
Well, I was pretty shy, and the best thing to do when you're in a situation like that is not to say much and just to sort of soldier along and suss it all out sort of thing.
It was very important us to do that because they'd never told their story before, so we wanted it to be in their words only, hearing from them telling their own stories for the first time.
The leaves are falling all around. Time I was on my way. Thanks to you, I'm much obliged for such a pleasant stay. But now it's time for me to go. The autumn moon lights my way. But now I smell the rain, and with it pain, and it's heading my way.
You establish how music consumed each of their lives at such an early age. And then there were years as successful studio musicians making well-known music that sounds nothing like Led Zeppelin. I was stunned to see footage in the film of the singer Shirley Bassey doing that hit single Goldfinger from the James Bond movie. And it turns out that Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones are playing on that song.
When they were going into these sessions, they were looking at what was going on and learning. They were staring. And so when you think of, like, you know, the grandeur of some of the Led Zeppelin music that would follow, these giant epic songs, Dazed and Confused and things like that, but also things like later on, like Kashmir. Well, you imagine you're sitting in Abbey Road Studio One, you're watching John Barry conducting, you know, this orchestra with Shirley Bassey singing Goldfinger. This is a huge sounding piece of music.
Pretty girl, where on this heart of gold? This heart is cold. He loves only gold.
And so they're drinking all this up, and then at the same time, you know, Jonesy's learning how to write and arrange these songs, and Jimmy, every single session, he's wandering into the control room and checking out how they're getting these sounds out of the mics, how they're making these effects on the records he's recording. And similarly with Robert Plant and John Bonham, you know, they're literally joining countless groups trying to pick up as much experience as they can. So really the message of the film is, if you got a passion as a kid and there's something you want to do, and maybe your parents are telling you, hey, you won't be able to do that, you just get a safer job, this film is about sticking to it. But as you carry on that path, do not waste a single day. Grab every opportunity. Like John Paul Jones says, never turn down work, whatever it is. And the message of the film is, yes, you can do it today, but you've, in order to do it, you've probably got to ignore all 90% of the things that people are telling you you should do.
That's what happened to us as well, wasn't it? Because we were told that nobody would want to watch a film with full songs in it. But we didn't listen to them. We believed that it's Led Zeppelin. Of course, the audience is going to watch full songs. And that's a message to young people as well, just to not to listen and to follow their heart.
We have been talking with producer, writer Allison McGordy and director Bernard McMahon about their new film about Led Zeppelin called Becoming Led Zeppelin. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for a Saturday, that was All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Thank you for joining us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Everywhere, I hid my head right in the bed and said,